Good morning. I startled myself. Easy to do. Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. I am really glad to have gotten the invitation from Greg and from Ken and from Rob to come speak to you this morning. I really enjoy getting over here and seeing so many friendly, familiar faces and a lot of faces that I don't know, and that's always great, too. It's nice to see that sort of growth. April and I attended here at Bulverde during our high school years. To clarify, we were not married at the time. And so we really had a lot of our formative mental experiences here. I'm just thinking about, off the top of my head, sort of the things that I learned, the examples that we had here. Larry really comes to mind. He put together a concerted effort to really focus on teaching the high school class the book of Ecclesiastes and the folly of worldliness and vanity. The character that Greg has exhibited to me, that undoubtedly you have seen exhibited by Greg also. I think also Patty, of really a tremendous example of what a godly woman looks like and what a good wife looks like. And so I'm really grateful to have been here at that time in my life, to have learned so much from you. And I'm happy to be here this morning. I want to talk this morning, about the book of Genesis and how that the book of Genesis, I believe, is so powerful and it's so useful in proving that God is who he says he is, that he does exist, that Jesus is the only way of salvation. And all of that really starts in the book of Genesis. I bring this up because I'm deeply concerned when I speak to Christians generally that Genesis, and specifically the story of creation, is something that we believe because we also believe in God, and so we kind of have to accept this inspired word of God when he says, well, I created the world, and we've been put on the defensive by the atheist or naturalistic crowd that says that evolution is the way that life came about, and the Big Bang kind of started the whole process. And we seem to have, in large part, and I'm not speaking individually, but I'm speaking generally, culturally, kind of accepted this idea that we are on the defense when it comes to Genesis. And I want to turn the tables for you, because I believe that Genesis, specifically the first chapter of Genesis, is one of the most powerful trump cards, if you will, that we hold in our defense of the gospel and proving to a person that what we believe is actually true, that its foundation is solid. And then for a Christian, that it really serves to bolster your faith, because you kind of realize when you really stop and think about what it says and what the implications are, that what we believe is actually true, and that we don't have to worry about, is this, you know, have we been misled? Have we missed it? Is there some other religion that maybe is true? And, you know, I know there has to be a God, but maybe it's not the God that I believe in. I think we can really answer a lot of those questions by looking at Genesis. I guess word got out, though, that we were going to be talking about Genesis. I stepped away from my seat for a second, and when I came back, there was a Noah's Ark book sitting where I was previously sitting. So if you put that there hoping that I would read this story to you this morning, you're going to be disappointed. So I'm going to apologize in advance. I won't be going through this. I might have ordinarily, but it's one of those books that you have to touch, and it'd be kind of hard in a crowd like this. So we're not going to go through this book. We will, however, go through Genesis chapter 1. We won't even make it through the first chapter. We probably, depending on your font size, won't even make it through the first page because there's so much there. So if you'll turn with me to chapter 1. But before we really get started in reading, I want to lay a sort of a philosophical foundation, something that we kind of have to understand before we get started. So this is a building. Okay, good. I didn't break those. This is a building in Billings, Montana. I've never actually been there. It's a museum of some sort. But it's in Billings, Montana. And so, show of hands, who's actually ever been to this building? Who's ever been to Billings, Montana? Okay, good. This will be a great example. So, if you were going to go to Billings, Montana this afternoon, you were going to jump in your car and start driving, how would you get there? And I think the answer that most people would say is, well, I would look at a map, or I would be really lazy and tell Google, give me turn-by-turn directions, and I would follow. And when it says turn left, I would turn left. And when it says turn right, I would turn right. And eventually, if I had enough gas to get there and enough time, I would reach this building in Billings, Montana. So the question is, why am I able to do that? And the answer is because I have a map that adequately describes the actual landscape. So that when I look at the map, and if I see that there is a road here and a body of water there and there's a city and another historical marker or whatever, when I look at the map, if it actually describes the landscape I see in reality, I learn to trust the map. Because every time I see something on the map, sure enough, there it is in reality. The problem, though, is, of course, what if you have a bad map or an old or outdated map? And so when you look at the map, you see features that do not match reality. Well, in that case, you would learn to not trust the map. But over time, you realize that every single time I've used, well, say Google Maps, and if you have a bad example or a bad experience with Google Maps, sorry, but every time I get in my car and I use Google Maps to get where I'm going, I always get there. And when it tells me to turn left, you can pretty much take it to the bank that I can turn left and that its description of reality, of the actual landscape, is accurate. And so this is the sort of mentality that we actually have, or should have, when we read the Bible or talk to people about anything, really, not even just religious matters or about navigation, because an adequate description of reality has a word, and that word is truth. And if the map is telling us something true, we can learn to trust it. And we can go to places like Billings, Montana, that we've never actually been, not because we have blind, wishful thinking that the map is correct, but because in the past, the map has an established track record of credibility with me. It has demonstrated that its description of reality is accurate, and so I can trust it about things that I can't personally verify, like how to get to this building. And when I follow that map, when I go places I've never been, sure enough, it adequately describes reality, and I actually get there. So this morning, that's what I want to do when we read through the book of Genesis, and that's why I've entitled this talk, Genesis, A Map of Reality. Because what I want to do is ask you to do something you've probably never been asked to do in a sermon before, and that is to not assume that this is the inspired word of God. This is just a regular book you found in a library, you picked it up, and you know nothing about it. And so let's take this map for a test drive and see whether it accurately depicts reality. So, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning. Well, there's our first dot on the map. And every time you see a dot on the map, that is a claim about reality. It's a claim that can either be proven true or false. So the thing that we have here before us is in the beginning. That's a dot on the map. And so the question is, this is a claim about reality. Is the claim true? In other words, did the universe have a beginning? And you might say, well, I don't know, I wasn't there to observe it. But I think it's very clear that the universe did have a beginning and that the universe must have a beginning, and I'll tell you why. So, here's a timeline. You are right here where it says now, as you can imagine. In the past, you see the years ticking down, and we have, let's just assume for a second, an eternal universe. That is to say that the universe has always been here and that the universe had no beginning. Now we've reached a problem already. If the universe is eternal, you could never actually get to now. And the reason for that is because you have an infinite procession of time, an infinite number of years in the past. So no matter how long has elapsed, whether it's a trillion years or 100 trillion years, by the definition of eternity, by the definition of infinity, you could never get through enough time, enough moments in time, rather, enough years to get to right now. Because there would always be an infinitely higher number of years in front of you, an infinitely greater number of years in front of you. And those may be hard to take in, but it's actually true. So the problem is, if the universe is eternal, by the definition of eternal, there is infinite time in the past. You could never get through all that time before now to get to now. So if the universe had no beginning, if the universe is eternal, now cannot happen. you can't be here hearing me speak to you. This cannot happen. So we know already that the universe must have had a finite beginning. That is an exact moment that from here on time can march forward and we can get to now, but it cannot be infinite in the past. There are also other problems with the idea that the universe is eternal. Other problems include, for example, the idea that if you take a cup of hot water and you put a tea bag into it, what happens? The tea diffuses into the hot water and the water cools to essentially a steady state at room temperature. The problem is, if the universe is infinite in the past, it has had an infinitely long time to cool and mix. And so we should have a cold mixture of essentially nothingness. The universe should be very cold and homogeneous. It should all be the same. But that's not what we observe. Mind you, we're talking about a map of reality. Does our description fit the landscape we see? We see hot bodies like the sun, and we see things that are not cold and things that are not just dead mixtures, like ourselves, that are actually walking around because the universe has not had an infinite time to cool and mix. So the first claim, the first truth claim here that the Bible makes is, in the beginning. And we've seen already that claim must be true. There must be a beginning to this universe. And so you may have heard, of course, about the Big Bang Theory. All right, well, there was nothing before. We all agree that the universe had a beginning. And so now there's nothing to dispute about. But that raises another issue, another question, and that is, in life, we have never observed something coming from nothing. If you went home this afternoon and there was a zebra standing in your living room, and you turned to your spouse and you said, how did this zebra get here? You would not accept it as an answer. Well, the zebra spontaneously appeared in the living room. It didn't come from anywhere. It has no cause. It just, boom, it's big zebra bang. Here it is, right? And so the problem with spontaneous existence is not solved when the zebra is the size of a planet or a universe even. The problem of spontaneous existence is always a problem. Something does not come from nothing. Unless that something that created the universe is outside the universe. That is to say, it's not part of the universe that we observe. And so whatever created the universe, by definition, is not natural. It is not part of nature. It is above, in a hierarchical sense, nature. We have a word for this too. It's supernatural. And so already the fact that there must be a beginning to the universe implies that there is a God. Now, I made Greg a promise that very quickly we would be able to see that Christianity is essentially the only rational worldview to hold. And so the fact that there must be a beginning and something requires something to create it or someone to create it, this already throws out the possibility of atheism. And it also throws out the possibility of several major world religions like Buddhism or Hinduism that believe that God is essentially all around you, like the Force in Star Wars. He's tied up in everything that exists. If that is true, then the universe could not have had a creator because the universe requires something outside of nature. It requires a supernatural cause. So if God is tied up in nature, then God himself cannot exist before the universe exists, and there would have been nothing to bring the universe and God into existence. And we have the spontaneous generation problem all over again. So in the first phrase of the Bible, we've gotten pretty deep into the fact that we're well on our way to the fact that what we observe around us, we have not assumed that this book is inspired, but what we observe around us must fit, or rather does fit, the map, this description of reality. Okay? So we'll move on here. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There we have it, a supernatural cause, just as we expected. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. Now we'll stop right there, because we've already run into another claim about reality that we can verify. It says that God saw that the light was good. He does not very curiously say God saw that he liked it. I'm sure that God did like it because the light was good. But rather it says he saw that the light was good, which is to say that goodness is a property of the light. So let me just take this down for a minute. When we say certain things are good or bad, we understand what we mean. So, for example, if I say that life is good and death is bad, those are properties of life and death. They're not properties of what I think about life and death. That is to say that they're objective good, properties of objective good, and not subjective good. They're true independently of what I think about them. So, the question is, this is a claim that the Bible makes, can you get objective good without God? Can murder be bad, for example, without God? And the answer is no. You must have good, or rather God, in order to have good. They're inextricably coupled. I'll show that to you. So here's the picture of evolution as you know it. Start with a monkey. Monkey gets a little taller and walks a little straighter. And eventually we end up with a man who's capable of cognition using tools just like us. And of course, this would not be the complete picture of evolution. It would look something more like this. Okay? So, if this is true, that we are here right now because of the survival of the fittest only, that is to say that things that can survive do survive, and as a result, here we are. Now I have a question for you. Is this immoral? Is it wrong for a shark to eat a fish, or even two fish? No, right? We make no morality claim about this whatsoever. It's neither moral nor immoral. We don't put cameras on the bottom of the ocean. You know, ladies and gentlemen of the fish jury, here it is, Exhibit A. This shark ate these two fish, guilty as charged, death row, right? We don't do that to fish. We don't care. It's not a moral question. It's just a fact that fish eat other fish. And I might add, this is evolution. So the theory goes. Survival of the fittest. This shark will go on surviving because it's more fit than these fish, and you know that because he's eating them, right? Okay, if you've seen the movie, he doesn't actually eat them, but pretend like he does, right? Okay, this is evolution. He's not wrong for eating those fish. It's survival of the fittest. Now I have another question for you. Is this wrong? And immediately you may be thinking, well, it depends. What are the circumstances? What if it's self-defense? What if, what if, what if? But notice, if we appeal to self-defense, we're already appealing to some justification. There has to be a reason why this is wrong. Because if this is unprovoked, just like this is unprovoked, all of a sudden this is wrong and it's murder and we all know it's bad and we're going to punish it. How do we get that idea from evolution? And the answer is, you don't. You can't get that idea. Now, I will grant you, there are some people who say, well, it's because evolution built in the survival of the fittest, and one thing that's fit is for me to desire that life is good, and so as a result of that, I've evolved a sort of moral consciousness, okay? Let's take that for a test drive, though. That, by the way, is called relativism. What is true for me may not be true for you. There is no map that describes reality. There is no map that describes the landscape as we know it. And this is the idea of relative truth. We all already know that's false from our experience in life. If someone tells you this is how you get to Billings, Montana, you would never say that's true for you. But for me, Billings, Montana is not north of here. It's on Australia. And so what's true for me is I have to get on an airplane and fly across the Pacific to get to Billings, Montana. No one would accept this. This is not a legitimate answer to the problem. But suddenly when we tackle morality, truth goes out the door, and what's true for me is not necessarily true for you. Back to our claim, though, about you cannot get morality, and morality, of course, is simply a subset of good. So if morality exists, then good exists, objectively. So if this is wrong, then we require something special about us. For example, you were created in the image of God. Wait a minute, that maps back to your map of reality that you're holding in your hands here on the page in Genesis 1. If you are not created in the image of God, and you are simply the product of evolution, we cannot say anything more about this. The relative morality does not give us anything more than, I don't like this. I can't say it's actually wrong. All I can say is it doesn't fit my preferences. Now, I had an astute person point out to me one time that I've actually changed the rules of the game here, because in this case, we have one type of species consuming a different type of species, but in this case, we have species on the same species, okay? Let's go back to nature. This is a black widow. It's called a black widow for a reason, because after mating, the female kills and eats the male. Is this immoral? It's the exact same thing as this picture here. but we haven't assumed cannibalism. All we've assumed is murder. But it's the exact same picture here. Is it immoral for a female black widow to kill a male black widow? After all, they're mates, right? It would certainly be immoral for you to kill your spouse. So why is this not immoral? And this is. And the answer is because we have grounded within us an objective morality that we get from God, because we are not simply the product of evolution. If you are the product of evolution, you cannot hold to morality. Those things are absolutely in conflict. And so as a result, the only thing we can say about, for example, the Black Widow and the Holocaust is that they differ only in the sense that the Holocaust was greater in scale and more efficient, but neither is more moral nor immoral than the other. We're forced to accept that the Holocaust was not bad. Does that fit your map, or does that map fit what you observe in reality? Absolutely not. Take that down so you don't have to look at it. Absolutely not. We all know we have some moral intuition given to us by God that the Holocaust is wrong. We also know that it is not wrong for a shark to eat a fish. And so now we have a problem that can only be solved by God. We have an objective moral law within us. That is to say, it's right regardless of what I think about it. We have an objective moral law within us that says that the Holocaust is absolutely wrong, and you can only hold that view if you believe in God. Incidentally, when I say it's objective in the sense that it's right regardless of what I think about it, what I, of course, mean by that is if the Nazis had succeeded in winning World War II and they had killed or brainwashed everybody who opposed them so that the entire earth was made of Nazis, that would not make the Holocaust right. That it would still be wrong, regardless of the fact that everybody was okay with it. And we all have a sense that this is true. And so the Bible tells us in this statement here that God saw that the light was good. We have a statement that God believes in objective morality. And there are, of course, multiple statements like this throughout the Bible. Another comes, for example, to mind, after the flood, or I'm sorry, before the flood, when God said the reason that he was sending the flood to the earth is because he was disappointed. There's his perspective, his mindset about it. He was sad that he had created man because he saw that only evil was in their hearts continually. There was an objective moral standard, and they had not met it. And not only had they not met objective good, they were doing the exact opposite all the time. And God was so upset about it that he had to stop it. Just like we were upset and had to stop the Nazis. It's the same problem. But you cannot have objective good without God. So if a person believes in evolution, of course your response is, how can you possibly account for objective moral good? You cannot get that from an evolutionary viewpoint. Now there will be people out there, some of the notable new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, etc., who will dispute this fact, and some of them will even say, well, I believe in relativism. That is to say, they'll admit, okay, sure, you can't have objective moral good. The Nazis simply aren't my preferences. But it turns out no one actually believes that in practice. And if someone tells you that they're a relativist, cut in line in front of them at HEB and see if they don't appeal to an objective standard of fairness. What you did is wrong. No, it isn't. To me, it's good to be in front of you. What's true for you is not true for me. So here we are. We're stuck with your worldview. Ideas have consequences. And one of the consequences of our belief system is that objective good exists. So moving on then, we see in verse 6, and God said, sorry, I'm looking at my clock here, and I actually have a little bit of time. So let me just mention this to you real quick. One of the consequences of objective moral good existing is that if objective moral good exists, a person cannot raise the challenge, I can't believe in God because of all the evil in the world. In order to believe in all the evil in the world, you first have to have a God, in which case that objection resolves to, I don't believe in a God who could create something I don't like, for example, Brussels sprouts. So that the objection is silly. Okay, we'll move on. If you read through this, and we don't have time to, between verse 6 and verse 19, we read a description of how God created the things that we, the major bodies that we see, the sun, moon, stars, and the earth. And I'll walk you through it with this really cheesy cartoon I drew, so pardon my terrible PowerPoint skills. But in the beginning, we read that the earth was non-existent, there was nothing, it was all void and empty. So here you have it, void and empty. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters, plural. And so here you have it, waters, plural. And then God said, let the waters below be gathered in one place. Let there be an expanse in the middle to separate the waters beneath from the waters above. So here you have it, waters gathered in one place. There's an expanse, just a gap, like there's an expanse between me and you. Waters below, waters above. Let dry land appear in the waters below. There it is. And in the expanse between the waters below and the waters above, put sun, moon, and stars there, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. So I got out a pencil, and I drew exactly what I saw, and here it is. Now you may say, well, the waters above are clouds. That's possible. I'm not dogmatic about it. But it doesn't seem to be, to me, to be the most pure rendering of the text. Get out a pencil, draw what you see, and I think you'll end up with something like this. So now we have a problem, because we said that our map fits reality. Our map matches what we observe. Is this what you observe when you look into the night sky with a telescope? I've never heard about this. If you have, kudos to you. However, what we said, going back to the beginning of our sermon, is that there are places that I don't know about. For example, that building in Billings, Montana. And that I can take it on good faith if my map is credible enough, if it's established a track record of credibility, that this is actually true, even though I can't personally verify it because I'm not standing there. It in fact may be that the reason you see stars out there and not water way out in deep space is because the stars are lit against a black background and the water is not. So you would not necessarily be able to observe it. However, on faith, I assumed, when I got out my pencil and drew this, and then converted it to PowerPoint, if the Bible says this exists, I bet it's probably out there. So I Googled it, and lo and behold, I know you can't read this, but this is from NASA, on the official NASA.gov webpage, NASA Mission News. I have a copy here that I'll read to you, the headline and the first paragraph. NASA Mission News, July 22nd, 2011. The headline reads, astronomers find largest, most distant reservoir of water. First paragraph. Two teams of astronomers have discovered the largest and farthest reservoir of water ever detected in the universe. The water, equivalent to 140 trillion times all the water in the world's ocean, surrounds a huge feeding black hole called a quasar more than 12 billion light years away. So now, let me ask you. Does this fit reality? Yes, absolutely it does. And just like our map to get us to Billings, Montana, it has predictive power about things I don't know exist. So now let me also ask you, if NASA discovered this in 2011, how is it that the ancient Jews knew about this in 2-ish thousand BC, at a time when people believed that the sun, moon, stars, ocean, etc. were gods themselves? And they had this laughable, absolutely ludicrous idea that the sun, moon, and stars, and ocean, and earth, etc., were not actually gods. They were just things, inanimate objects, that the one true God who exists outside of nature created and brought into existence. And that the universe has a purpose, and that is to be a habitat for us. Does that fit reality? Absolutely it does. And I bet you don't know anybody who still follows ancient Canaanite or Egyptian or Persian or whatever religions, but somehow this map matches reality so well that it's enduring and we still believe it. These are great challenges to a person who does not believe in God, let me tell you. And I hope that they're actually very faith-building for you. The other thing, too, and you can barely see this is a picture of the surface of Mars. And if you believed in evolution, which is to say there's a Big Bang and it spewed matter out and that matter collected and cooled, you would kind of expect things to look like this, like the surface of Mars. But you would never expect something to look like this. How did this get here? It seems as though, from looking around, that we live on a privileged planet that is comprised mostly of water, something this author could never have verified but indicated in the text. How did this get here? It doesn't fit any other mental model other than a creator. And I'll tell you, I know you can't read this, maybe you can. There are many people who believe that if you can't get something purely from science, then it has to be thrown out as a form of legitimate discussion. The problem with that, of course, is you can't hold that view purely from science. Science will not tell you that. That's a philosophical view you hold about science. And this is a quote from Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope is named, from 1937. He was one of the guys that really got the Big Bang Theory off the ground. And he said, such a condition, and what he's referring to is the fact that if you look in the night sky, it kind of appears that we live in a very special place. From the standpoint of the way the galaxies operate. Well, my timer's up. Sorry about that. From the way the galaxies kind of appear to be moving away from us, the fact that the moon is millions of times smaller than the sun, and yet it's perfectly at the same distance so that you can have a sun and a moon that are exactly the same size the way that we view them from the ground, as though there's a lesser light to rule the night and a greater light to rule the day. All these things that he observed as an astronomer, he didn't like, and he said, such a condition would imply that we occupy a unique position in the universe. But the unwelcome supposition of a favored location, that is that the Earth is special, must be avoided at all costs. It is intolerable, and moreover, it represents a discrepancy with the theory. And the theory is that we're nothing, we came from soup, we're just like everything else, we're not special. Because the theory postulates homogeneity, that is that we're all the same, that we're just like matter, we're molecules clashing in the universe. And so here you have one of the guys who is a major proponent of modern material atheism, telling you his view of that is because he presupposes a philosophical foundation that says that there is no God. And the evidence that he observes to the contrary is intolerable. He's not even willing to think about it because it contradicts what he wants to be true. These are the guys who are in charge of your children's curriculum. And they're also the people who are challenging you, telling that you're insane for believing that Genesis is true. But I think the exact opposite is the case, that Genesis is a major tool in your armament, and you should use it to bolster your own faith and to reject, as Paul would say, foolish philosophies. One final couple of comments I'll give you. These two guys, I'm sure you're familiar with. This is Charles Darwin. He's Louis Pasteur, after whom your milk is named pasteurized. Pasteur was not setting out to figure out how to make your milk survive longer in the refrigerator. His experiments were to determine something that was still an unsettled scientific question in the late 1800s at the same time Darwin was coming up with the origin of species, and that question is, can life come from non-life? Darwin believed it could, as did many other people in his day. No one really knew until Pasteur. So he did all of his experiments. He put all kinds of various liquids, water, juice from meat, all kinds of stuff in flasks, boiled them, sealed them, and saw if life came from non-life. And it turns out here's one of his flasks in a museum in London. It's been sealed for 150 years now, and there's still no life in there. No life has spontaneously come from non-life. So if you are not a Christian, you're forced to believe that the universe came from nothing, that the universe may in fact be eternal, that life comes from non-life, that consciousness comes from matter, that objective morality comes from subjective opinions about good. There are too many things that a person must accept in order to be a naturalist. And I will tell you, we are only in the first 19 verses of the Bible. Think about how powerful the message is that this entire book contains, and we haven't even left the first page. And this is exactly why I am a disciple of Jesus of Nazareth, and you are too. Because Jesus was who he claimed to be. He described the world the way it actually is. He told you things about yourself that you know are true, namely that you are a sinner, that you and I do bad things, and we need repentance and we need forgiveness. The answer to all of those problems is not throwing out good. When we throw out God and we throw out objective good, we don't get rid of the evil. We only get rid of the solution. And this is exactly what Jesus was talking about when he famously said in John 8:32, you shall know Key word. Not believe, not think, not hope. You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. And the truth is, what Jesus went on to say just a couple of verses later, before Abraham was, I am. And then he said, unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. I know he was right. You know he was right. And if you need to do something about it this morning, let's get it done as we stand and sing.